It's the Metal Show with Gully and Joe, and this week we are talking Rainbow. No, we're not talking about the kids' programme that was on UK television when we all grew up. We're talking about Ritchie Blackmore and Rainbow. Now, first thing I'm going to say, really, for me, is like any band that puts someone's name in the band title, I'm not a fan of per se anyway, so this should just be known as Rainbow for me. And it's the first three albums with Dio involved. And it's an overview, but me being me, I've typed up a little bit on every song because fuck it. It just gives me something to do during Lockdown Central. Here we are, and this is what we're doing. So, Joe, when did you first hear any of Rainbow? I probably would have heard it when I first got into rock, really.
Just wanted to interject. I wanted to do a bit of, with the lockdown and everything going on, I wanted to do a bit of cleaning up shop and kind of go through the backlog a little bit. I wanted to finish off the Sabbath series, and I thought and you said about wanting to do Dio, so I thought it'd be a good way to start with Dio and then finish off Black Sabbath and then move on with the Dio albums with Sabbath. And I know you're a little bit with Sabbath about Ozzy, but I just thought if we did this first, you've got a bit more context of what Dio would have been bringing to the table, especially after you listened to the last two Sabbath albums, because I think that, not that giving too many spoilers away, there's some redeeming features on those two albums, but it was pretty, I think when you do them two and then go on to Heaven and Hell, it's pretty apparent what he brought. What he contributes. I thought it'd be good to do this.
One hell of a vocalist as well.
And I didn't want to do one album per episode and So I thought we'd do this all in one lump and then we can move on with Sabbath.
Yeah, and we've got a new album come up as well to do for May, is it?
So, yes.
But like I don't know about you, but I don't even know what day it is from one day to the fucking next at the moment. It's just fucking mad.
We've got the guitarist from that band coming on as well.
So. We'll do a double lender where we talk to him and then we review it with him not being there in case we don't like it.
I don't know. Yeah, I think he's going to pick an album to review though. So I don't know if you want to do a two-parter or one big long one. So we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah, we'll do a two-parter then, fuck it. We'll do a review with one and him. So, we've had quite a few different people coming on of late because everyone's locked up like a cunt. Let's start at the beginning. Formed in 1975. It's one of them for me. The first ever denim jacket I got off my uncle it had a rainbow patch on when I was like, I don't know, must have been about 13, 14. And it didn't fit because it was a bit fat, but I still put it on. And it had a rainbow patch on, and I never really knew who they were. But I came across some of the music with just listening to rock in general and listening to the radio. And it was more so now with the age of digital and online radio, you do hear a lot more of the older stuff than you do back in the day, because rock radio stations back in the day would only play what was new and what was hot and what was happening and stuff. And nowadays with the classic rock, you kind of get a broader spectrum, and I think it's opened out this type of music for a lot more ears. So like your Planet Rocks and your absolute classic rocks in the UK, I've heard a lot of these songs anyway that before I'd even like started listening to the albums fully. So it's been interesting to know that I knew it already, which is, it's weird, but you know, because most people, when you've got the radio on, you're always doing something else. So it's in the background and you go, well, that's a good track. And then listening to these albums in particular, being like, oh, fuck yeah, I've heard this fucking a shitload of times. And it's a current phenomenon. That with them, yeah. But like I said, first album's up, the debut album, the cover's mad. It's like an acid trip or something. It's a little bit, ooh, what's going on there? Like, it's of its day. And you can say that about a lot of the tracks you'll hear. It's definitely of its day, but that doesn't necessarily make it shit, I think. But yeah, Where are you with how you got into them and that? Is it a similar scenario where you've listened to it and then you've gone back and explored older bands? How do you get into
basically,
these?
Yeah. I think I first heard Rainbow. I mean, who doesn't know Since You've Been Gone? I Surrender was another one I knew. I probably knew who Rainbow were when at work in the workshop. A couple of guys used to bring in CDs and tapes. Mm. There was one particular guy who sort of helped me fill in a load of gaps. He was a bit older than me. He was a bit of an older rocker. And he had a greatest hits of Rainbow, and it just had a picture of Black Richie Blackmore on the cover. Mm. But when you've opened up the card, like you took the booklet out, it unfolded and it was like a Rainbow sort of family tree. Mm. So I knew that Ronnie James Dio was in them at some point, and da 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 da. He explained to me that the Dio years were probably the better years. And then I think when I started later on getting into Sabbath, but then started buying the later albums, and then buying Ozzy's solo albums, and obviously grew up with Sabbath, the early Sabbath, from my dad's collection, but I started filling in gaps. And then, yeah, obviously getting into Dio, and then Rainbow is kind of like the connection of it all, because everyone kind of leapfrogs from Sabbath to Rainbow to Purple in one order or another. If you look at get Sabbath, Deep Purple, Rainbow, and then just look at all the people. Everyone just seems to jump from the three bands before like leapfrogging into a solo career.
Did they think it was like with the name? Did they think it because of Deep Purple, Richie Blackmore's name had more value to put it on the name of the band? I'm not a fan of it, but I can understand it. If that's the case, everyone, then fair enough.
Loads of people did it back then, though. Well, I wouldn't look too deep into it. I mean, the first Fleetwood Mac album is called Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac.
Mm.
It's just a... I suppose it was a solo album to begin with, a solo band. He was obviously the bigger name. He had quit Deep Purple. Elf, who Ronnie James Dio was singing in at the time, was a support band. He liked his voice. He wanted to do his own thing. I don't know exactly of it. Someone a bit more into Purple, or I'm paraphrasing really, but I know Richie Blackmore and Ian Gillan famously didn't get on. And when they reformed, again, it didn't last very long, like one or two albums at most. Mm. Richie Blackmore is known to be very pedantic and sort of capricious. Is that another word?
Mm.
He's hard to get on with. So, I mean, yeah, I guess you only have to look at the amount of lineup changes Rainbow went through. So I guess it may have been something to do with a record label, I don't know. But yeah, Richie Blackmore's Rainbow is the original title. It obviously became Rainbow going forward. Good little thing, though, with Ronnie, when he was, when Richie said, you know, do you want to form a new band, or I'm going to be doing a new album and I want you to sing on it? He said, I'm not doing it without the guys in Elf. If you're going to hire me, you have to hire them as well. So it helped give them a leg up, which I thought was pretty honourable.
He seemed like a jolly good chap, did Dio, though, in that respect. Yeah, he tend to look after his own.
He took no shit off people. He was always honest, for better for worse. You never heard him lying in an interview. You might not have liked what you heard, but you got it the way he saw it. So, yeah, so this first album is pretty much Elf with Richie Blackmore on guitar. This lineup as well never played live, I believe, as well.
Mm.
Interesting little tidbit there.
I would have expected they would have done a tour on the back of it, though.
No, apparently not.
That's fucking bizarre.
Yeah.
But I think then was probably you'd make more on the album sales then than you would on the tour, and I think that probably was the case. Maybe they didn't need to.
Maybe, yeah, this sold off the back of Richie Blackmore's name, and then when it came to the second album, which is only a year later, they started touring then. Maybe these musicians weren't up for... But then again, they were touring with Elf. I don't know what happened, but...
Mm. Well, let's go a little run through from it from a few tracks. I've just typed out notes for every little song as I normally do, but like the opener's good. I like you were saying I think we could say Richie Blackmore's a bit egotistical. So if anyone was going to put their name on a band, I think it'd be him. Like the first track's not offensive at all. It's not un heavy, not un too scary for the non-rock fan. And this is the more approachable of like this type of music. I would say it's quite easy, and like Dio totally owns the vocals, and good little opener on it, and I didn't mind Man on the Silver Mountain either. I thought it was a good little track. None of it is offensive in any way. The all three albums, I'm not totally like going to go, oh fuck, I'm turning this off. There's filler, of course there is, but nothing you wouldn't leave on if it was on in the background. I think that's a safe thing to say.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same. I think this first album obviously is them trying different things out, throwing shit at the wall and seeing what sticks is a common phrase I use. I think what would go on, what would go on to become Rainbow is nothing from this album reflects that now, but it does reflect what would go on to happen with Dio.
Yeah.
I think I think like certain songs on this, I mean, there's no song on here I dislike. I think there's one or two that I think are filler, but there's about four or five, which is like, right, these we're going to carry on and build from. So Man on the Silver Mountain, I think, is it's a staple Dio song, not so much Rainbow. I think as well, where Rainbow changed like so dramatically in terms of style and sound, these three albums basically became part of Dio's canon. In his repertoire rather than Rainbow's, because they stopped and started a couple of times. I remember him saying in an interview as well, he's like, well, Rainbow don't exist anymore and Sabbath don't play any of the songs I played with them, so no one else is using the song, so there's no reason why I can't. So he's like, I've got those to add to my set list as well as my own stuff. Like he still carried on playing these songs in his solo band. But yeah, Man on a Silver Mountain is a staple Dio song. I think it's one of the songs he's known for. The song's a lot heavier live and went on to be heavier in his solo bands when he did pull it out. I think Self-Portrait's quite a good little hidden gem. It's got catchy hooks on it, isn't it?
I think the first three are all right. Self-Portrait's got catchy hooks. Black Sheep of the Family, it's not a bad track. It's just a nice, easy listener.
It's a standard 70s.
Yeah.
Rock, yeah.
I think when we get to Catch to the Rainbow, I like the little mellowness of it. I like the track that adds a bit of contrast, and I love the lazy sounding solo, like he's half-arsed or he's stoned when he's playing it, and it's that stands out for me as one of the better tracks of the album so far, because it's like I wasn't expecting that. That's quite cool, and it's definitely a taking you on a journey album, taking you through it. It's a listen to all of it or not at all album, I think, so you can get a better perspective of what they were trying to achieve with it. But yeah, Catch the Rainbow, that's probably a standout track for it so far for me.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic piece of music. I think Richie Blackmore shines on guitar with his emotional playing and good melodies that he writes. I think Richie Blackmore's actually a fucking underrated guitarist when all's said and done. He's never mentioned in like top 10 lists or anything like that. And the guy wrote fucking the first riff anyone who picks up a guitar learns to play. And that's Smoke on the Water. The guy fucking wrote that, you know. But yeah, I think trying to do a bit of hindsight here, because when did this come out? 1979. So this is about... No, even 1975.
75. Yeah, so I wasn't even in a twinkle in anyone's eye.
10 years before I was even born, so I can't exactly tell anyone what it was like then, but I would have thought a Deep Purple fan picking this up, this is Richie Blackmore's new band, and I think the first three are good enough, but I think this would have been the track where you'd gone, right, we're onto something here. Because if this isn't one of the, if you don't consider this one of the greatest vocal tracks ever recorded in rock, I don't know what you're playing at, really. Because his voice is so fucking just so confident and smooth, and the way he, even at the end as well, where he just does that,
it's got a vocal presence of, yeah, of someone that's like 10 feet taller than he actually is.
Apparently he played trumpet in the school orchestra, so he'd never actually had any singing lessons. He already knew how to sort of manipulate his lungs to make
Definitely belt it out. Like, that makes sense.
And like, it's not a weird, like when he's during that chorus, the way he just builds up and builds up, and he just never, he never goes too far either. He can kind of just do, he was always aware of what he was capable of, and he always used it to the optimum. You know, you never heard of Dio just sort of belting out some higher note for the sake of doing it. He always served the song. And yeah, I think this is definitely, this is what going forward, there's like, right, we're going to hold on to that one.
Mm.
And then going into the second half, there's again, I think there's a lot of hidden gems on this album. I think it fades into the background quite well. Is it Temple of the King?
Yeah.
I'm just going through some tracks here.
Yeah.
Again, a really mellow song.
Mm.
That you didn't hear much of going forward, really. I mean, they got a lot heavier.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think Snake Charm is all right.
Yes, yeah, not a good song.
There's little bass fills that you don't, because obviously they scrapped the whole band besides Dio and Richie Blackmore on the next album, and you can tell the little bass fills in Snake Charmer are good. And it's a great little number. Temple of the King, again, yeah, I'm with you on that one. It's got plenty of highlights. This Temple of the King kind of, there's a little fight to see who's the best track. And Temple of the King's another good one. If you don't like rock and roll, it's got a rockabilly vibe to it. I find it's like, yeah, it's defo rockabilly going on, and then six.
That's killer filler for me. I think it's nice enough, but it's you can do without it moving forward.
Yeah,
It's all right while it's on, and because it's only 2.5 minutes, it doesn't really.
But yeah, what the fuck are you gonna do if it's on? It's on. It's one of them. It's like, is it worth the effort for me to press a button to make it fuck off? And no, that's the answer. 16th Century Greensleeve, some of the names of these tracks are mad. The opening riff, but it's cheese. It's another rocky little track, and Still I'm Sad. Nice, heavy, and the last track on the album, especially for me, it's just cowbell mad. And the funk, there's like a funk kind of drum rhythm to it. And I think it's a good little way to close off the album in general, and there wasn't anything that I found utterly offensive, and I actually enjoyed listening to it as a package. And I haven't really much more to say, because we're not really going as in-depth as we normally do, because there's three fucking albums. What do you want from us?
Yeah, this is more of an overview rather than just going straight into it. But I think it's a good... I'm a bit of a sucker for a musical, an instrumental, sorry. I think a really good one, up in there, you know, Transylvania by Iron Maiden, Ryan, or Call of Cthulhu by Metallica. Give me that over the fucking minute and a half intro any day. I think it's a mark of a really good band that can fucking just jam out. And it's something that's missing a lot today. You just don't get them as much. But funnily enough, on the live album on stage, Still I'm Sad goes on for 11 minutes, and there's actually vocals on it as well.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, that's one thing as well.
What'd you do for 11 minutes, though? what'd you do with yourself for that
long? Looking at Metal Archives here, apparently it's a Yardbirds cover as well.
Interesting. Didn't know that.
But one thing as well with their live albums, I mean, there's one official live album, but now you can go on Amazon and it's literally, I think you can pretty much get every night of a certain tour. You could literally get about 10 live albums with Dio, but a lot, and the set list always changes as well. But the thing is, like this one as well, there's six songs on this live album, and it's on for nearly a fucking hour. Catch the Rainbow goes on for 15 minutes.
Fuck.
There's a medley of Man on the Silver Mountain.
Well, we're in the 70s, so people would have been probably off the tits.
It was really jammy back then.
Yeah, like the Hendrix vibe.
Yeah, so I think these studio version of these, where they're a bit more compressed and a bit more, they just get on with it, I think benefits them. But yeah, definitely worth checking out Rainbow Live. So yeah, should we make these?
Well, I'll give it I'm going to give it an 8. That's what I'm going to do. A cheeky 8. It wasn't offensive. I actually enjoyed the journey with it. There was nothing shite about it. An 8 because it was consistent.
Yeah, it's not a perfect album, but the stuff that is good is fucking good.
Yeah.
And I think going forward with Dio's catalogue, there's some nice hidden gems in there that a lot of people do forget about. I think, you know, especially Catch the Rainbow, Temple of the King. Snake Charmer is actually a really good song, actually.
Yeah, I don't mind that.
Yeah.
Let's go on to Rising. So they fucked off all the band besides Dio and Blackmore, and you can tell, actually. I think the bassist suffers from here on in. There's less of the little cheeky fills, and the less it seems to be a little bit more on point. But at the same time, this is where it gets a little bit better album-wise for me, because it's heavier, for one. And a lot of my favourite Dio songs can be found in the next two albums, to be fair. So you got Tarot Woman, and who doesn't know this? It's like one of them, it's the Metallica medley, which you'll find there's some the ones where they do on, it was on that tribute to Dio that they had all sorts on. This is in the Metallica medley, this song, and this is one of my favourite Dio songs. It's a long song, but yeah, it's a good little track, Tarot Woman, and I have to say it's one of my favourite tracks by Mr. Dio in particular, because it's a fucking top song.
This is just the epitome of the 70s rock album, isn't it? Like prototype heavy metal. Look at that fantastic album cover.
Oh, yeah.
It's magnificent as much as it is cheesy.
Yeah, there is fondue.
I do love it.
There is fondue.
I watched, in fact, I meant to send you this interview with Ronnie in 1994. He's having a particularly bad day, and he fucking does not, there's no prisoners in this interview. He is honest with everyone, and he cunts everyone off. Tony Iommi, Richie Blackmore, and
nice.
But there's this really good little bit, and I always try and do this if I've got a lot of time. I like to go through the catalogue with the people and let them reflect on certain albums. And this guy turns up with the little CD booklets of all the albums, puts it apart, and he literally just goes through each one. And he says, like, how he feels how underrated the first album is. He goes, a lot of people, Rising is their favourite. He went, I always say, go back to this one. There's some good stuff on this. Now, he actually doesn't like Rising very much. I agree. I know what he means, but I also disagree. He says that this album's very jammy, very self-indulgent. There was always loads of solos and blah, 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 blah. They're on there, but not quite to the extent of what he says. I think he needs to...
I think the first one's a bit more self-indulgent at times. I think this is more on point.
Tarot Woman starts with quite that lengthy...
The keyboard madness.
Which doesn't bother me.
No, no problem.
Stargazer kicks off with that drum solo. But I don't think they really outstay their welcome. I think... However, there is different mixes of the album, and there is different versions of the album.
Yes, so, New York mix is the one I listen to. Because you get the two on the special edition that came out. You got the New York and the other one. I just listened to the New York one to say fucking about it.
I've not got that one. Yeah, or I've just got a standard issue, so I don't know.
I don't know what the fucking difference is, and I wasn't really going to just get into fucking listening to it twice.
Stargazer is backed by an orchestra.
Yeah.
On one, and on the other one, Stargaze is longer with a keyboard solo. Apparently, that's the main
thing.
Tarot Woman, fantastic song, including the keyboard intro.
Oh, yeah.
It's stomping as it goes along as well. And funny enough, I was kind of mutual with the song. I could take it or leave it. It wasn't a song I particularly went for, but wasn't one I turned off either. But there's a DVD of Dio. It's quite recent as well. When he did Holy Diver in Full.
Nice.
And he opens the show with Tarot Woman.
Cool.
And I'm seeing it live with the current band and seeing how well the song had aged made me appreciate it a hell of a lot more.
Well, a DVD certainly beats a fucking hologram.
Yes, yeah,
so
absolutely.
Fuck let's your not, hologram. And I, hopefully not. with this pandemic, that might have put kill to that as well, because that was just a fucking piss take. I'm sorry. I'm not going to sit there watching a fucking telly screen. I might as well buy a DVD.
I just wish they didn't. Ronnie wasn't the first one they tried it on. And again, watch that interview that I said about, and watch any. I've said this before, but fuck it, we're talking about him. So you go on YouTube and look, type in Ronnie James Dio interview and watch 5 minutes of any given one. You would know he would have been the first to go, fuck off, I am not doing that. Bollocks.
No.
That's bullshit. I'm okay with Dio Disciples, though. I saw that show and it's a really good band, and the fact that they're doing Tim Owens is sort of like the mainstay, but you normally get two or more singers per show. And it's a tribute of his whole catalogue. That's fine, got nothing with that, but a hologram's just fucking cheap. It's just
bollocks. Yeah. And it is whether or not you think it is or not, it is a cash grab. And it's plain and simple. It's just cash grab.
Yeah, but I think it would have been gone happy to go see Dio Disciples anyway. And I will suggest one thing, putting it out there. I think Dio Disciples should do a tour with Joey Belladonna from Anthrax running. I think that'd be a fucking phenomenal show.
Yeah, let's hope the recent pandemic hasn't put to death all our tours in the future. We were saying just before the show that it may have a fucking and a really horrible effect on the music industry. We were saying we practically think it could have killed a lot of stuff that's going to happen, and it has this year, but hopefully it comes back next year, and that's what we all want, really.
Moving forward, I think a big thing, if this doesn't get put under control by everyone, really, I mean, there's no country not affected by it, but I think the biggest issue is going to be travel insurance.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a case of, can bands even afford to do it? So when, you know, going forward, when a concert does come round your way, make sure you fucking go to it. Because if they've come to this, do a tour, and they're playing to half-empty venues, they're just simply not going to bother doing it again. It's not going to pay off. So you really got to vote with your wallet in this one.
Yeah,
not to be too preachy, but
it's true, and it's not even just the band's insurance. The venues are going to have a bit more insurance now. If you're in the insurance industry, once you've made your big payout to all these businesses, you're going to be raking it in for the next fucking few fucking decades there. But yeah, it's going to affect all of us in that respect. And I'm not going to do what a lot of bands are doing and saying go out and buy the merchandise and all that. Support them when they're about. If you want to buy a t-shirt, that's good, give them some money. But everyone's suffering, and a lot of people aren't going to be shelling out for a t-shirt for the sake of supporting the band they love.
I think a lot of that is bands that were I know Suffocation and I know Mayhem, just two off the top of my head. They had tours cancelled. I know Mayhem in particular. It was like literally like 3 days before they were meant to, like, their first show. The whole tour just got, just, you know, came to a standstill. Like, they said, like, flights have been cancelled. It's like, it's just going to be a nightmare, and we're probably not going to be able to get home. So I know that was the case with Suffocation and Mayhem, and it was a case of, well, we've already printed the T-shirt, so if you wanted to have, you know, if you were going to come to a show and buy one anyway, here they are, they're available.
That's fair enough.
Clearance of stock, yeah.
But you're like,
but when you weren't touring anyway,
and you're just like, help us survive.
Support the band that we're doing part time.
Yeah, support our weed habit and a beer whilst we're sat at home like every fucker else.
It's double edged sword. Some bands were jumping on it, but on the other hand, you can't blame some bands for trying to stay financially afloat while they probably start off a tour in debt.
Can I just ask the question from your experience, and I'll comment on it as well. How much do you think nowadays, in the age of digital recording and everyone can record a studio quality album at home now, how much would you say it would cost to professionally do a single?
I don't know.
Would you say £1,500 is an excessive amount?
I honestly don't know. I've always said you can record at home all you like, but you need a proper studio to do vocals and drums. If you want to save money and do the guitars at home, fair enough. Mm. But you definitely need the drums in a proper studio. And it depends who you've got as well. I mean,
I think an album £1,500 is probably about right. But for a single, no. I'm saying that because someone I know round here is in a band that has got a GoFundMe thing that's just come up and they've asked for £1,500. I don't think they actually made that.
£1,500.
Yes, yeah. for a single. And I don't think that they made it. And to be honest, my opinion, I'm not going to donate. I couldn't give a fuck, to be honest. I don't really like the band. But asking that much for a single, a recording, an actual single, maybe is a bit of a well, I don't know, piss take. So I'm not going to name the band because I don't like them. So why even publicise them? But asking for that much, I don't know. Especially with the dawn of digital recording, because like the stuff you've got there and I've got, we could record fucking a full album between us.
Yeah, it really depends, because if you're paying for the studio, you've got the staff in the studio, you've got mixing it as well, that's another person, so you've got the engineer, the producer, and then you're going to give the person to mix it. One song, I think if it goes swimmingly, you're looking at 8 hours mixing.
Mm.
So that's a day's wages for someone.
Mm.
I don't know, it fucking depends. I'll tell you one thing, no matter what you plan on budgeting, it's going to go over. I guarantee you that.
Mm.
Nothing ever, and the time always flies by in the studio.
I think for me as well, it's a case of it's the value for value. It's like I'm all for bands asking for crowdfunds, and in certain respects, like if they do a, like, you get a special little edition signed and you get a little t-shirt or a drum skin, that's fine, give them added value. But just sticking your hand out and saying, can we have money to record a single, no you fucking can't.
It's
one of them. Everyone's in the same boat, I think. But anyway, let's get back to the album, because I was having a little mini rant there.
Right, yeah.
So, Tarot Woman, great. Run With The Wolf, fist pumping metal. Nice little slide guitar on it. And this is definitely a heavier album. Starstruck, I'm into it. It's more precise, the bass. It's a decent enough track, but it bridges the gap to what follows well. And then you got, like, Do You Close Your Eyes. It's not a bad track, but it's a bit fillery, that one.
It's got the fucking worst line ever as well. Do You Close Your Eyes When You're Making Love? Who the fuck? It's like, what's that band? Oh, what's his name? He's singing Bad Company 3.
Ah, yeah.
Paul Rogers.
Paul Rogers, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He was in Queen for a bit as well.
Yeah. Feel that making love.
Feel that making love.
Do you close your eyes when you're making love?
It's definitely filler. It's definitely filler.
And that doesn't suit Dio at all. No. He was never like that. I don't know
I can't imagine him thrusting his codpiece out. I could imagine Blackmore doing it, but I couldn't imagine him doing it.
Little inkling aside, this would be a perfect album.
Yeah. Stargazer, I love the intro on the drums on that, man. This is another one of my favourite Dio songs.
This is the masterpiece in my
Stargazer. And to get some big Led Zeppelin vibes from it, and it's like a fucking, it's a really long song. The last two songs on this album are fucking, you couldn't keep people's attention span long enough nowadays, I think. But like, really, really long song, great track, love it. Light in the Black, another one of my favourite tracks with Dio in. The music's up tempo and it's a long song, but you don't notice. And the album for me, in general, it steps it up quality wise. It is a bit keyboard heavy, but as a package as a whole, they are quite heavier. And for me, Light in the Black, top track and a proper way to seal the deal and finish the album. And I'll do my little rating once you've closed up your little mini review.
Tarot Woman, again, we've covered that. I think Lock at the Wolf is a good little stomper.
Fist pumping in it.
It's one of them.
Oi.
It sets the scene, but Run With The Wolf sort of carries on things on nicely. I really like Lady Starstruck. Again, it's just a good 70s rock song. Fantastic chorus. You can't not sing along to it. Mm. The Do You Close Your Eyes is a bit of,
it's a bit
that little thing aside, but it's 3 minutes, I can deal with it.
Yeah, could be worse.
Stargazer, I think, is one of the greatest heavy metal songs ever.
Yeah.
I think every so often a song comes along where all the members of the band are on top form. So there's not like everyone might shine either drums on this or the riff on that. I think all five are fantastic on this and they gel perfectly. Mm. Another song comes to mind where I just think everyone is just on form. It's Thin Lizzy's Waiting for an Alibi.
Waiting for
two very
an
different
alibi.
Songs. Yeah, that fucking that bass, dun 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 dun. And then Twin Lees, like both straight away coming in together.
One thing I always wanted to ask as well, were they big drinkers, Thin Lizzy? Because they've got that sound of a band that like to have a drink, and it came across in the music a little bit. Sounded like?
I think drink was the fucking least.
fair enough.
Look into the story yourself, yeah.
Drugs are bad.
Yeah, drink. Yeah. White powder, needles, everything went on in that band. But we'll have to do a Thin Lizzy's episode at some point. It's long overdue.
Yeah, we have to.
But yeah, Stargazer, it's just so fucking dramatic. And it's just has a right amount of cheese without going over the top. And it's quite a repetitive song. But every layer, like every time the chorus comes along, it's just that bit more dramatic.
And yeah.
It's
operatic at times, isn't it? It's kind of operatic. Yeah, yeah.
And just to add a big add, when it
yeah,
you just picture the story because it's about some sort of Babylonian. He's building a tower, which he's going to fly to heaven from, and when he jumps, he just falls flat on the fucking floor. But it just builds up to this massive climax, and yeah, it was that. You've got orchestra. I always thought it was keyboard, but obviously not. You've got an orchestra playing in the background there. And Cozzy Powell's drumming, again, I think this is one of the things that puts Cozzy on the map. He just locks that beat in.
It's unexpected. Unexpected rhythm patterns as well, which I like. They're unexpected.
And the main riff is actually a keyboard.
Yeah.
Really unique song. No one's ever done anything like it again. And Dio didn't play it every show, but when he did pull it off, like it would be an occasion. But yeah, done live, it's fucking brilliant. And when I saw Dio's Disciples, they did it, but it was pretty good. They didn't do the drum intro, they didn't introduce it. They just kind of finished the song and just sort of held a note. So it's like, yeah, and then just. So it just completely caught everyone by surprise. They just went straight into the main riff, and it was you just saw the crowd just sort of suddenly realise, and and it was the sort of centrepiece.
Can you remember that gig where there's a festival where they have just a whole fucking a whole weekend of like cover bands, and I'm sure there was a Dio one, there was a fucking Led Zeppelin one, and there was the fucking Aussie Pink Floyd and all this. I think that would be, you know what, as much as
there's a few of them.
I think it's down south, and I remember seeing that, like there was the Thin Lizzy one and all this, and I was just thinking, do you know what, take it for what it is, have a few beers and enjoy someone doing a fucking really good cover of the bands you were into would be a cracking little day out, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, double-edged sword with them. I think they're all well and good and all well and fun, but I think the industry is a little too reliant on them, booking agents especially.
Oh, yeah, for pubs and, pubs and small venues, you're getting fucking slapped in the face with fucking cover bands all day.
I mean, I know someone who's fantastic at their instrument. I won't say too much because it sounds like I'm calling them out and I'm going to pop them. I'm really not. But I think it says more about the fucking public than it does about him. But he does a tribute band for a well-known band. And he's selling out fucking
money
venues. I don't begrudge him it, but it's just like, for fuck's sake, I've seen.
We need
in
creativity,
these phenomenal
really.
Bands all these years, and doing a fucking covers band is where you're making it.
That's a common thing, though. The promoters and people who book these venues are going for the easy fucking sell. And it's going to get worse, I think, instead of better with everything that's gone on. I think that's only going to get worse, and we're only going to be able to see. I think London's going to take a slap for fucking gigs as well, because London, you were so lucky. I don't think as many people are going to be doing it as much now. I think a lot of people have just gone, well, fuck it. is it worth coming out to play that little shitty venue in Camden that we love, the Underworld? It, I think many bands are just going to end up saying, nah, fuck it. It's not worth it anymore.
It's not going to be worth. Is it going to be? Yes, it's not going to be worth the risk. Or no. And I think a lot of it has, with the cover bands. I think there's a lot. I think the X Factor in reality shows has a lot on it as well, because people just want to hear what they know. They don't want to. They don't want to seek out stuff that's new.
Yeah. That's why I think we should. We're guilty of concentrating on the old, but we're trying to spice it up with new stuff ourselves. But have you got anything for Light in the Black, the closer?
Yeah, I've completely forgot about that one, didn't I?
Well, it's fucking 8 minutes nearly, so I hope not.
Yeah, no, really good fucking song. This reminds me a lot of Deep Purple, actually, this track.
But, yeah, I see that.
Again, it's 8 minutes long. You don't even notice
no,
it.
No, not at all. It's a bit keyboard heavy. I think this is the album where they have a good go on the keyboards. The Ivory gets a good old slapping, but yeah, you don't notice it. You don't notice anything with it, and that's not like it's not like you're in the lift and you hear the lift music and you're like duh, and you're tapping your feet. It's not offensive stuff and it's good. And I enjoyed this album a bit more than the last one, and. Based on that, I'd give it a 9. A 9. Yeah, fucking absolute. Some classic songs on here. Like, fucking, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I've got this T-shirt. I mean, I think it's one of my staple albums, and it's one of Dio's classics in his career.
Agreed.
And I think it is. It's rightfully regarded as a classic, and it is. And I think both albums, either side of it, are both underrated because this album just sort of towers above the two of them. But, you know, a band finding their feet and are on fine form.
Yeah. Long Live Rock and Roll came out in the one of the best years of the 70s, 77, when I was born. Long Live Rock and Roll's good opener. Everyone knows this one, though. This is one that you'll hear often on the Planet Rocks of the world, in the classic rocks. You'll hear this pop up a lot often. This differs again. It kind of changes. The songs are a bit shorter, and most of the majority are going to be under 5 minutes as well, which I don't mind either way, because if you don't notice it, that doesn't matter how long it is. But yeah, I like Long Live Rock and Roll. Catchy hooks on it as well. It's more of a straightforward rock and roll album, this one. It's a lot less proggy, because it was a bit proggy the previous one. There was a bit more dragging out of the songs. Not to a detriment either, I think.
I think the only way forward would have gone to be like to go full on proggy and full on technical and all the rest of it. Well, obviously Dio wasn't a fan of that from what he said.
Yeah.
But, so with this one, it's like they've taken what they mastered on the last album, but put it into just digestible sort of small bites, really. Just like, no, this would make 12 straightforward songs. Kind of like what Metallica tried to do with Load, but didn't.
Yeah, that's true. So,
well, they did. It just wasn't very good.
I'll do the first few, go up, and then I'll drop off before Kill to the King. Like, Lady of the Lake, more straightforward, more rock and roll. I do find it a bit of filler, that one. It's not a bad track, like, but yeah, it's all right. LA Collection, again, I was less interested in this, and I know it was probably one that Dio would do a lot, I think, but I wasn't really into it that much. And then you got Gates of Babylon, and the keyboards come back for a vengeance. But when it kicks in, there's a funky drum beat spiced in with the keyboard overtones, and Dio just going nuts. So I actually like that one. It's definitely a song you could have on whilst driving or travelling, and it's definitely the standout track so far on the album. It's got some good solos with it as well, and I do get like a Middle Eastern feeling from it as well. There's Led Zeppelin bits, overtones and all sorts, and Gates of Babylon's probably a standout track from the first half of the album for me.
Yeah, definitely. I think Long Live Rock and Roll is just it's a good little rocker. It does what it says on the tin. It's a great little chorus, great vocals, and I think this starts a trend going forward with Dio as well, because, you know, especially those first like 3 or 4 solo albums, it was always like songs like We Rock, Stand Up and Shout, King of Rock and Roll. It was like, oh, he always had like a good rock and roll. He always kind of chucked this in as well, even if he just did the whole, like during like a drum solo or during like a solo, or at the end of a song, he'll just start going, "Long live rock and roll," and end up get the audience to sing it back to him. And they obviously instantly recognised it. So it kind of become a thing like that with Dio. But yeah, a song we all know. It's an earworm. You'll instantly know it. I think Lady of the Lake is a real, again, another hidden gem that a lot of people kind of forget about. I think it's got a great little Zeppelin-y. And Dio's vocals on this, the way the vocals are layered as the chorus goes on, it's kind of got that haunting sort of background. And then, yeah, just, I think it's got a fantastic chorus, and then it all just sort of builds up and builds up, and then to that, "Lady of the Lake," and then it comes back to that opening, you know. But yeah, I think it's a great song. LA Connection's a good little, again, a 70s rocker. I think that riff going through it's really good. Cozy Powell's got like a real good stomp underneath it as well. It's funny because Dio, even taking like the front covers of the first two albums, he's building this sort of mystical fantasy, which was Dio's always did. He was always, you know, made no secret. He liked reading Lord of the Rings. He liked reading fantasy books.
He was very wizardy.
Always tried to portray that. Yeah, and he tried portraying that in his music because he says, "I wanted escapism. I wanted like a kid in their room to sort of disappear into this sort of land."
Yeah, definitely.
That I was making. And he always wrote great, perfectly vague lyrics as well, where it was open for interpretation. So then, with that being said, the next album comes on. It's just a portrait of the band, Long Live Rock and Roll. And then we've got this song about the LA Connection. It's like, all right, okay.
Drugs.
All well and good, but it's kind of just, yeah, where did that come from? I was in, you know, Stargazing and Lady of the Lake and The Castle and the Hill, and, you know, and then, yeah, LA Connection. It's like this CD sort of dirty rock and roll song, just kind of, all right. Mind you, saying that, I do like it, but I do think it kind of messes with the flow.
Yeah,
it seems
a little bit odd, that one for me.
I don't dislike it, though. Gates of Babylon is what I said to you earlier in the week. I forwarded it to our group chat. I think this is prototype Iron Maiden. I can picture Bruce Dickinson singing this, with a big full-on production that Maiden had, with the flames in the background and God knows what else. I think like that. With that, you know, it brings to mind sort of a song like Power Slave, you know. But no, a highlight on the album for me, I think that's what you said, when you said this is one of the standout tracks. Yeah, definitely. Classic track, classic Dio song, and definitely a highlight on the album for me.
Killer King, love this track. It's a major one from Dio. It's an up-tempo, good rocking little number. Great little solos and fast riffs. And this is a speeding down the road track, this one. Totally love it from beginner to end. And then you've got the worst name for a song, but a great place to record the podcast, The Shed. it's a nice little solo to start, but big long intro, but I just find that was kind of, they just wedged that into Philly. The tempo on this album in general is higher than the previous two. Sensitive to Light, it's a little bit more focus on the uplifting riffs, and it seems to be like a happy kind of sound and song for me. I love the solos and the singing together, and I found it a fairly positive song, Sensitive to Light, even though the lyrical content might say otherwise. The riffs and the way the vocals are sounding, it sounds like a happy song. It kind of reminds me of Black Sabbath, where like Ozzy could be singing about someone dying, but it just sounds happy. It's just one of them songs. And then we've got Rainbows to finish off. You got a bluesy riff, like a Hey Joe, Jimi Hendrix vibe going on with it. And it's one of the longer songs at over 7 minutes, and there's a flute. It's very, very bardy, very brave. So Robin, it's a mellow song. I suspect it may kick in further down the line with the song, but it never actually came. Definitely a good want to show people how good Dio can sing. I think, but like a nice mellow one to close out the album and to close out his time with the band. I think it's kind of like it caps it off for me. And yeah, it's different and there is more rocking moments to it. But again, none of it really got on me tits. Not one song.
No, yeah. Again, I think this is actually, whilst doing this episode and listening back, I think this is one of the underrated albums in rock music. Like so many people, they just kind of forget it. It's kind of one of those albums that you, when you've got like your whole collection of a certain band, it seems to me like the album that you get to complete the collection. So if you're a Dio fan, you're not so much about. I mean, I'm not actually a bigger Rainbow fan. I've got the Dio era of Rainbow, and that's for my Dio collection. It's not the Rainbow or Deep Purple collection. Do you know what I mean? So. And I'm guilty of this as well. So I'm talking about myself here, probably.
No, we all pick and choose. Yeah, I've got these Dio songs on separate albums on CD. The mainstays are on different albums, like The Greatest Rock Ever and all this shit. They're on there. But like a lot of the songs that were new to me when I found them, some for the better and some for the worse, The Shed. But yeah.
Yeah. But this to me was the album I needed just to fill that gap in the collection, and I was neither here nor there with it. And listening to it now, it's like, fucking hell, this was a fucking faultless album. But there isn't a song on it I don't like. Covering the second half, Kill the King. Funnily enough, before this album came out, you had the live album on stage. And this was the song that opened the album.
Wow.
So if you were on the ball and following them as they went along, you would have already had a version of this song. Which is why I suppose they put it in halfway. But I think it's a great live set opener. I mean, if I was doing like a Dio tribute,
it's kind of like the Four Leaf Clover that Metallica's on. You'd heard it loads live before it actually got put down on an album, because they were fucking hammering it to death.
Well, that was the it was a new song on S&M, wasn't it? Therefore, the single released from it. Did they ever actually do a proper studio
on one of the wanky albums, Loads of Reloads, or one of them ones no one cares about? But I didn't mind the song, because I remember when I first saw that live, and I was like, that's a fucking Metallica, or still Metallica track. And then lo and behold, they weren't. But yeah.
But no, great set opener, and I think it would have been a good album, actually. And I think Long Live Rock and Roll could have gone on at the end or something like that. But regardless, doesn't matter. Fantastic introduction. I just love the way it just explodes. And Cozy Powell doing, building the song up. It kicks into that awesome riff. Brilliant fucking chorus. Again, a staple of Dio. It's just that style that he would go on to be known for. And it's funny, going from Rainbow to Sabbath to his solo band, and then obviously the later incarnations of the solo band for the different lineup changes. Dio just had this way of coming into a band and just making it sound like Dio.
Yeah, he had a stamp.
He had a stamp. And even going forward, when we cover the Black Sabbath albums, you'll think of them as Dio albums. It's part of the Dio collection rather than they do have their separate.
It's going to be one of them like stamps that you get the Dave, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago, has got one. He'll send a letter and he's got a wax stamp and he can stamp it with. When you say like stamp, I just immediately thought of really old letters on parchment with a wax stamp with a D. Do you know what I mean? Stuff like that.
But if you just take like Rainbow, which are kind of like a rockier version of Purple, because Richie Blackmore was getting fed up with, I think Deep Purple going a bit funky at the time. And I think he wanted to keep it like more heavy. So that's, I guess, where the keyboards come from on this thing, because obviously Deep Purple had John Lord. But you take Rainbow, Sabbath, and then obviously, like, they're very different bands musically speaking, and yet somehow Dio just manages to link them all just with his vocals. That's just something that he didn't really get enough credit for, I don't think.
Definitely.
But The Shed, it's got a nice Hendrix like that main riff, with that stomp underneath it.
I just couldn't get a grip on it. I was just like, I think maybe I should have ignored the name a little bit, but the shed, I don't know, it's just, the only thing exciting that happens in the shed is our podcast, Joe. And everything else, I just think of like lawnmowers and fucking, I don't know, it's something about the name that just killed it for me, and I don't know why.
The Shed and Sensitive Delight, the two songs together are a bit of killer filler for me, actually. They're not particularly standouts, but again, they're fast-paced, they move along nicely, and kind of just pass the time, but pass the time well. I mean, again, Sensitive Delight, it's over in 3 minutes, and it just kind of, it rocks and it rolls along, you know. It's, again, nothing offensive there. Rainbow Eyes, the closer, to me, one of the overlooked performances by Ronnie. I think this is one of his best ever vocal tracks. So sort of tender and melancholic. Again, just with the acute, like just the guitar with the flute in the background. It's got a bit of folkiness to it, but just real beautiful vocals. And again, you can, it's open to interpretation what the song's about, but it doesn't really matter. It's a song I'll pull out now and then during that mellow time when you just want to forget everything. And there's certain mellow songs that I pick out where I just want to be left alone and just breathe for a minute. And this is one of them. I mean, I even went for a phase of listening to the song before going to sleep. I just put my headphones in and just sort of drift off to it. Because it's like a little lullaby. But he never did anything. This is the first thing he did with it. And he never did anything like this going forward in any of his bands. And it's a real shame because I think, you know, a song like Catch the Rainbow and this particularly, I wish he did a bit more of it because it's fucking phenomenal. It's a real beautiful.
It's definitely a song to showcase his vocal talent as well. It's one thing that stuck out more than other tracks we've listened to. It's like, fucking hell, he's going for it there.
I mean, if I was a bit older and a bit more successful, and if I was in a band in the 90s or something and I ended up doing Unplugged, I would fucking have covered this song.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. You'd have to have a fucking flute person too. What do you call a flute player? What is the name for it? You got a drummer, plays the drums, a flutist. What is the verb for it? I don't know. Is flutist is fucking flute word? Player. I don't know.
A nerd.
A guy with a really fucking, he's doing duck face all the time, so he's probably great at selfies because he plays the flute.
I'm wondering who did the flute. Oh, it's the recorder. Is there a difference between a recorder?
Well, I could play the recorder in school, so maybe we can pull this off ourselves.
What's the the recorder's,
it's a little
like a
plastic
fucking
thing.
Yeah, flutes that you hold to the side, so there was no, what's the thing that Jethro Tull, the guy in Jethro Tull, sits there with
piccolo flute? I don't know.
Yeah. I was looking into it thinking maybe he played on it or something.
It's like one of them, isn't it?
No. What the fuck Ritchie Blackmore was thinking when he built this foundation. He's left a real successful band, built this new band from the ground up. He did three fantastic albums, a really good live album off the back of it as well on stage. Let's check that out. To just turn around and just go, I want to go more commercial. And this is what happened. He said to John, I want to be more commercial. I want to start doing love songs. And that was it. And Dio was like, well, that's me fucked because I'm not doing that. And he just left, which, again, pretty defiant for Ronnie. And it just so happens the Sabbath job came up, but he didn't know that was going to happen. I think as well, they originally was going to be forming a new band. I think Sabbath were going to split up. And then I think as time went on, I think the
name value
just went,
money.
Yeah, we can put this out as a new band and you literally have to start again, or you just put it out as Black Sabbath and you've got an audience, even if it's just to turn up and slack it off, people are still going to look at it. So I think that was more of a case than what went on. But the next album, and in all fairness, Down to Earth is a bit of a guilty pleasure of mine. I don't actually dislike the album. I like, you know, All Night Long and fucking the cover since you've been gone. It's a good, it's good fun.
Everyone knows music. it, so it probably sold yeah. loads.
I wanna love you all night long. Yeah. Fair enough, but don't fucking sacrifice what you've got going on here to do that. What the fuck was you thinking?
Did he make more money after or before? That would be interesting to know whether it actually worked, and if it worked, fair play to him.
I don't really care because he was fucking successful anyway at this point. The guy's in deep purple, yeah. for fuck's sake. And it's not as if none of these albums... I mean, the momentum they would have been building, another album probably would have gone on to become a classic anyway. Yeah, I don't know. And then after this, he went on and got Jolyn Turner, who was in Deep Purple for about 5 minutes. I don't know if he was in Deep Purple first... but yeah, he did The Difficult Cure and, you know, I Surrender and all that stuff. Again, it was fair enough. It didn't, I think he joined Deep Purple afterwards. I'm just looking up here. Yeah, he did 3 albums with Rainbow and then joined, then did 1 album with Deep Purple. But just looking through it here, I Surrender, it's not a bad song, I suppose. But it's radio rock. You know what I mean? It's nothing.
There's nothing out there or experimental.
It's nothing that isn't on these first three. You know, and I don't know. Yeah, what the fuck is he thinking?
You can't change the past. But like, I'm gonna give it a little cheeky 7 for this one. I think the middle album for me is the diamond. But it's 7 out of 10. It's well deserved. There's some differences and it's a bit more rocking and the tempo's off for me. So again, nothing here to fucking. Make me go, apart from The Shed being the name of the song.
Again, yeah. As with all of them, really, what is, it's not perfect, but what is good is fucking good. And, you know, Gates of Babylon and what was the other one? Lady in the Lake. And again, it's worth buying just for fucking Rainbow Eyes alone. It's a fucking fantastic song. So I'll match you, actually. I was going to say 8, but I'll match you with a 7.
It's not non-offensive music, and I think the experience of listening to all three and finding stuff I haven't found before was pleasant, and it wasn't an unhappy time. It wasn't like Testament, the last review, if you haven't heard that, fucking hell, it's a doozy. But this has been enjoyable for me. I think I've got my shit album from the year gone from the last show, definitely, but all three of these, they're definitely staying on the playlist, and if it comes on again, I'm not going to go, oh fuck, I'll have to listen to that again, I'm only just reviewed it. No, I'd listen to it again because it's good music.
Let us know what you think as well going forward. I mean, we're still going to be doing episodes where we focus on one album solely, but do you want a bit more where we concentrate on an era rather than an album? I think that's a good little thing to do as well.
I also like taking a standoff as well, because you can go really in depth, and the standoff one works as well.
I don't think I've missed anything out here, but there's nothing. If we did them like 3 separate episodes, we probably would have gone into more detail. But I don't think there's anything that I feel like.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't feel like we've missed anything in particular. And I've gone in writing a little bit for each track, and some less than others, like The Shed. I just couldn't get into it. But have you got anything coming out, or are we all on coronavirus hold?
We're all on coronavirus. All on hold at the moment, mate. It's the podcast and
well, we've been certainly very productive with it. So if you enjoy the show, share the show. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere where you can hear us call you a cunt, we're on. If you enjoy it, share it. Don't be a cunt. Thank you very much for listening. See you later.
Ta-da.